Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andrew Rubin, director of the International Coalition of Academics Against Occupation, who talks about the deteriorating conditions in Iraq, an issue now becoming the focus of the U.S. presidential election campaign. Ted Wayman, deputy director of the Uranium Medical Research Center, who discusses his study into the health effects of depleted uranium weapons now being used by the U.S. military in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And Seibel Edmonds, a former FBI language specialist, fired after revealing problems at the agency, who explains why she and other former federal security officials have criticized the 9/11 Commission report. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Reuters reports that the Israeli army conducted its most violent raid into the West Bank in over 2 years. The mid-September operations killed 6 Palestinian fighters and 4 civilians, including an 11-year-old girl, in raids in Nablus and Jenin. 4 of the slain gunmen were from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a part of Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement, and another militant was a member of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The crackdown on the West Bank is seen by observers as a prelude to the Sharon government's disengagement process that will lead to the evacuation of 8,000 Jewish settlers from Gaza and selected outposts in the West Bank. Still, many Palestinians doubt Sharon's aims in the pullout from Gaza next year. They say it will put Israel in a stronger position to dominate the West Bank, the home to nearly 240,000 Jewish settlers in Palestinian areas. Sharon, in a recent interview with the Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronoh, declared that the roadmap to Middle East peace was essentially dead. In response, Arafat advisor Nabil Abu Radiana replied that Sharon is exploiting the U.S. government's preoccupation with re-election. It is a dangerous turn of events. The Center for Public Integrity reports that the U.S. Justice Department has neglected to maintain the computer database for its Foreign Agent Registration Unit, which has decayed to the point that it can't copy the contents of the database. Created in 1938 to track Nazi spies, the Foreign Registration Unit now monitors lobbying activists on behalf of foreign governments, companies, and foundations. Justice Department spokesman Byron Sierra says the information in the database is still available to the public, but it costs 50 cents a page for documents that can be hundreds of pages long. None of the foreign agent files are available online, even though a bare-bone list of lobbyists for foreign interests is on the office's website. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the current index is a year and a half old. The names listed in the database of the Foreign Agent Registration Unit read like a who's who of the Washington power lobbyists. At the top of the list is the law firm Patton Boggs, representing the interests of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Angola. There is also the Livingston Group, led by former House Speaker Bob Livingston, whose clients' list include Turkey and the Cayman Islands. USA Today reports that the U.S. Customs Service this summer seized 450 packages of prescription drugs ordered through a Canadian company by patients from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Vermont. This is the first large-scale sting operation by the Customs Service and the Federal Food and Drug Administration to halt shipments by a Canadian pharmacy. The action was taken because increased demand for Canadian drugs has forced mail-order companies to obtain drugs from Europe and Australia. As a result, the drugs cannot be shipped directly from Canada. In this case, the orders were placed by CanadaRx.net, which set up a distribution site in the Bahamas where it received prescription drugs from European wholesalers. After the raid, the FDA notified the patients that their orders had been seized. But critics of the FDA say the Bush administration is using a double standard in this case. They say components of many prescription drugs sold legally in the U.S. are often made in foreign factories. Chris Lizzi, a spokeswoman for Minnesota Senator Mark Dayton, a strong backer of drug importation from Canada, explained that hundreds of seniors are calling and asking the whereabouts of the prescription drugs they had ordered. retired manager Lloyd Carrigan of Shreveville, Minnesota, ran out of his prostate cancer medicine while he waited for his CanadaRx.net order to arrive. In frustration, he got another local prescription from his doctor that cost him three times as much as the Canadian pharmaceuticals. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
As the presidential election campaign heats up, the war in Iraq is emerging as a defining issue which could determine the winner this November. An escalation of insurgent attacks, suicide bombings and kidnappings, and executions of civilian hostages is focusing public attention on a deteriorating situation for U.S. forces in Iraq. This, despite continuing tit-for-tat controversies surrounding both candidates' Vietnam-era military service and a recent scandal at CBS News about questionable documents from President Bush's National Guard service. Although President Bush is upbeat about what he calls progress in Iraq, a national intelligence estimate given to the White House in July predicts continued violence and chaos in Iraq as the better of several scenarios, the worst being civil war. Large areas of central Iraq, including major cities like Fallujah, are now under the control of insurgents. The U.S. military is reported to be planning a major, potentially bloody offensive in these areas after the U.S. election. Prominent Republican Senators Chuck Hagel, Richard Lugar, and John McCain have begun to publicly question Mr. Bush's Iraq policies. Meanwhile, Democratic candidate John Kerry has stepped up his criticism of the president's decision to go to war and his current handling of the conflict. Andrew Rubin is a professor of English literature at Georgetown University and director of the International Coalition of Academics Against Occupation, a group which has worked to bring public attention to the assassinations of more than 250 college professors, academics, and intellectuals in Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rubin about the current conditions in Iraq and the viable options for the U.S. to extricate itself from what many are now calling a quagmire not unlike the Vietnam War.
What the occupation has managed to achieve has been the virtually unprecedented, I mean, there's some precedent, but virtually unprecedented unification between, on the one hand, secular Arab nationalist forces in Iraqi society and, on the other hand, Islamic fundamentalists, both of whom have found a common cause in removing, dislodging, disrupting, destroying the ongoing occupation. Once that occupation ends, there's certainly, I think, a very good chance of a civil war. But in the meantime, you know, things certainly have grown more sectarian, factional. The U.S. commanders on the ground who can't control certain cities gives treatment to certain warlords in these regions, arming them, letting them make decisions to so-called stabilize or neutralize, as I guess they said in Vietnam, these areas. So there is a certain kind of factionalism and sectarianism. The U.S., the way they manage this occupation is partly to blame by privileging certain groups over others, the Kurds and so on. And it's the way decisions have been made haven't been democratic, but have been based upon a kind of what tribe, what ethnic group, what faction is the best strongman for Iraq's security. And that doesn't necessarily equate or translate into any kind of real democracy.
Andrew Rubin, I wanted to ask you about Iraqi public opinion. There have been a number of polls indicating that many Iraqis, if not most of them, oppose the U.S. occupation of Iraq. But I wonder what that means towards U.S. plans to remain in Iraq indefinitely, maybe decades longer, putting permanent military bases there. Do you get the sense that the Iraqi people would like to institute an Islamic fundamentalist government similar to that of Iran?
The U.S. coalition, the provisional authority, the group responsible for the occupation, had taken a poll in 2004. They found that 80% of Iraqis said that they had, quote, no confidence in either the U.S. civilian authorities or the coalition forces, and that 55% of them, you know, over a majority, would feel safer if the U.S. and foreign troops left the country immediately. No one in Iraq is sad, I'm sure, to see Saddam Hussein out of power. Certainly as many, maybe a little less, are very disturbed, not just in Iraq, but around the Arab world, to see the United States occupying in a very reckless way. Most people would, I think, prefer that the United States leave immediately, but I don't think that that necessarily would mean the development, you know, a complete radicalization of Iraqi civil society so that it's attracted to, you know, terrorist groups like al-Qaeda and so on. Though al-Qaeda's group, we should point out, since the Iraq War began, according to a London Institute of International Strategic Studies, al-Qaeda's membership has risen in Iraq from about 1,000 to 18,000, which is huge. The longer the U.S. stays, I think the longer the risk is of some kind of, I'm not sure, a theocratic government, but it's certainly empowering a lot of them in ways as a political force. And the most major and miraculous thing was that the Arab nationalists who protest in the tradition of someone like Nasser and so on, find themselves for the first time side by side by basically a nationalist Islamic fundamentalist movement, which is a kind of power that, first of all, the United States has never contended with.
As we come up to the November presidential election, you have both President Bush and Senator John Kerry, his opponent, talking about staying in Iraq to win. But what is your forecast for the United States forces if that commitment of staying in Iraq to win and defeat the insurgents remains in place?
Yeah, I don't think the United States can win this war. I don't think this is a war or even peace that can be won militarily at all. I just think that means the death of thousands upon thousands of more lives. The difference between Kerry and Bush is that Kerry's more of a multilateralist, and that he'll reestablish ties with West European allies who Bush had snubbed. And Bush will do things unilaterally and quite preemptively without diplomatic approval, and not seek diplomatic solutions and use military solutions. But I don't see any fundamental difference, really. I believe that Kerry is called upon NATO, and I don't see that as any kind of real substantial difference as far as Iraqis are concerned, and the way the ongoing so-called attempt to win the peace, you know, since the end of the war began, hundreds and hundreds of more people have died. That's no peace. So in the short term, you know, in terms of the election, I'm not optimistic about the possibilities for any kind of real solution to this ongoing problem.
That was Andrew Rubin, a professor of English literature at Georgetown University and director of the International Coalition of Academics Against Occupation. Contact the coalition by calling area code 202-492-3291 or visit their website at www.icaao.org. Project Censored is a media research group at Sonoma State University that tracks news articles published in independent journals and newsletters. From these, the group compiles an annual list of 25 significant stories that have been overlooked, underreported, or self-censored by the country's major national news media. The project publishes the stories in a yearbook titled Censored, The News That Didn't Make the News. Ranked this year as the fourth most important censored story is High Levels of Uranium Found in Troops and Civilians. Two of five articles cited under this heading were written by Ted Wayman, deputy director of the Uranium Medical Research Center based in Toronto, Canada, and Washington, D.C. Wayman was honored for reports he wrote about the use of uranium weapons used by the U.S. in the war in Afghanistan. These conventional weapons contain uranium, classified as depleted uranium, or DU. Despite the label, these weapons are still radioactive. Uranium is considered an ideal weapon material due to its density and increased ability to penetrate its target. Wayman has conducted health studies in both Iraq, where DU weapons were deployed, and also in Afghanistan, where weapons containing non-depleted uranium were used. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke to Wayman about his research.
Afghanistan was extremely traumatic personal experience for me. I was shaken right to my core because over there the uranium was used in experimental bombs, and that was the days when the bunker busters were, the name bunker buster became well known, and those cave penetrating weapons and what even were called seismic shock bombs. So these were very large bombs in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 5,000 pounds. I found my first day in Afghanistan a village in which the entire village was no more than a kilometer away from where a bombing sortie had occurred on a kind of a military, quasi-military outpost in Jalalabad area, which is near the Pakistan border. And all the people in the village were standing watching the bombers fire their bombs. These bombs came down, very big explosions, went deep into the earth, threw an awful lot of material up into the air as a smoke plume, flashed odd colors, and then that smoke plume, full of dust, dirt, debris, and of course, as we found out later, uranium particles, came across their village. All these people were covered with it, like the dust you could wipe off your skin, off your clothes, off your, you know, window ledge, because it was such a high quantity. Within a few minutes of exposure, people started to feel funny. They had throat, nasal problems, bleeding in the nose. Within 24 hours, almost everybody who had been exposed was having kind of very bad runny noses. They woke up in the morning with blood in their throat and in their noses. And then over several weeks, they developed a variety of flu-like or cold-like symptoms, but also a stomach flu-type symptoms, which then progressed on to a whole series of very classic symptoms that we call the symptoms of uranium internal contamination. Lower back aches, which reflect the kidney damage, cervical column or neck pains, progressive and repeating gastrointestinal problems, unexplained headaches that would be extremely bad, like a migraine headache that would come and go at odd times, night sweats, inability to sleep, intermittent fevers, and neurological problems in which they had started to lose their memory and so on. So these were the classic symptoms.
So these are very serious short or medium-term effects. What about the long-term impact of uranium exposure?
I think you could say there's three categories or classes of effects in uranium internal contamination from these weapons. One is the overall, what we might call systemic breakdown, leading to immune system failure, and then people leading a life not dissimilar to those who might have AIDS, in which you don't have the immune system strength to be able to handle viruses and bacteria. Then what they call the mutagenic effects. They slice through cells and they break the DNA, which separates genes from cells and breaks genes and destroys them and prevents the basic central mechanism that control the reproduction of cells from working properly. And if the cells don't repair themselves properly, they can mutate, and then you have the development of precancerous and potentially cancerous formations. And this can happen in several organs in the body. The third area is what they call the congenital effects, which is there seems to be some preponderance of problems in the offspring of both veterans and Iraqi civilians and Afghan civilians, in which there are several birth defects seem to be consistent in certain populations that have been exposed to uranium weapons. But the first two areas, these immune system breakdown and long-term effects, and the potentially cancerous effects in those exposed directly, are known to be scientifically and medically factual. The birth defects is not been well enough studied to determine that that is in fact the case. Although I must say, having seen those photographs, I've interviewed the doctors in Basra in Iraq who can show that the timing of the onset of both cancer in people, children and adults, as well as the timing of the onset of birth defects and the mothers from whom those children with birth defects come from, they are very confident that it corresponds to exposure to uranium.
There's so much abhorrence around the world to the idea of dropping a nuclear bomb on civilian populations, yet this exposure to uranium from what are called conventional weapons goes on in many countries, and we hardly hear about it except from project-censored stories.
A nuclear bomb that we might drop on a country, a terrible thing to do, or in a battlefield, only contains up to a few tens of pounds to less than 100 pounds of radioactive material. It is the burst of radioactivity from the explosion called neutron radiation and gamma radiation that does the damage. But these uranium conventional weapons, we're not talking about a few tens to a few hundreds of pounds of material. We're talking about tons and tons and tons of it. So, in fact, if you add it all up, it is much greater than a single or even a group of nuclear explosions, because it's there continuously and it's releasing continuously and the quantities are much higher.
That was Ted Wayman of the Uranium Medical Research Center. His reports have been honored by Project Censored. For more information, call the Research Center at area code 416-465-1341 or visit the group's website at www.umrc.net. Sybil Edmonds worked as a contract linguist for the FBI, but when she reported lapses in security, mishandling of critical intelligence and cover-ups, she was terminated from her job in March 2002. Edmonds' subsequent lawsuits asserting she was fired for being a whistleblower have been labeled top secret by Attorney General John Ashcroft, and neither she, her attorney, or Congress can discuss specifics of the case. One of several lawsuits filed by Edmonds in July 2002 was dismissed by a federal court in July 2004 when a judge found that Edmonds could not prove her case without access to information the government has classified as protected by state secrets privilege. Edmonds has testified before the U.S. Senate and the 9/11 Commission that the FBI possessed but mismanaged information that could have proved useful in preventing the September 11th terrorist attacks. More recently, Edmonds has helped organize a group of 25 former federal employees directly involved in the government's counterintelligence and counterterrorism work who have publicly criticized the 9/11 Commission and the Bush administration for not holding key officials accountable for failures leading up to the September 11th attacks. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sybil Edmonds, who describes what led her to speak out against pre-9/11 problems at the FBI, the Bush administration gag order around her case, and why she and other former security officials have criticized the commission investigating the September 11th attacks.
Certain translators were language specialists were hired by the Bureau, and they were granted top secret clearance. And later we found out in the Bureau that some of these individuals actually had ongoing relationship with the targets of FBI's investigations, and they were leaking information from the Bureau to those individuals. Also, there were certain translations that were intentionally blocked from being translated, and that was related to these security breaches. And also, a lot of translations that I did for various languages consisted of documents obtained before 9/11, and they were not either translated due to backlog or they were translated and no action was taken. I started reporting these issues initially within the Bureau itself, and I went as high as to director of the Bureau, Director Mueller, and his assistant Dale Watson. They did not want to take any actions, and actually they asked me to go along with covering up these issues. So I took these issues to the Senate in March 7, 2002, and I also reported these issues together with the evidence and documents with the Department of Justice's Inspector General's office. And 2 weeks later, I was terminated, and the only reason they cited was purely for the convenience of the government. And since then, we have been challenging the government. However, they have gone as far as gagging the Congress. They stopped the Senate investigation of these issues by gagging the Senate by retroactively classifying all these documents and information. And they also stopped all our court procedures by asserting this rarely invoked state secret privilege, saying that discussing these issues in court will damage certain diplomatic relations and damage certain foreign business relations.
If the American people knew about these problems within the FBI and the specific information that you're aware of and many inside the FBI are aware of in terms of early warnings about 9/11 that could have been used to possibly prevent the attacks, what do you think the reaction of the American people would be?
it would be outrage and it would be demand for accountability, because you're not looking only at one person, let's say for myself coming forward. Just in past 2 years, 9, 10 agents have come forward. And in a way, it's really sad, because by not holding people responsible, accountable, they are stigmatizing the agents who are doing their jobs and they are working hard. And that's majority of the bureau. But within the mid-level bureaucrats there, the mid-level management layers there, you have certain individuals that either intentionally or due to incompetence or the combination of both, hindering investigations and jeopardizing our security.
Sybil Edmonds, tell us about the group of 25 former federal employees that you helped organize that came forward to criticize the 9/11 Commission and the Bush administration for not holding officials accountable for their failures leading up to the September 11th attacks.
Yes, I testified for the commission, for the 9/11 Commission, and I also encouraged others who went forward and they gave information to the 9/11 Commission. They testified, other translators, other agents. After this report came out, that same day, I went there and I purchased it, and I spent 3 days reading this report. A lot of information just was totally omitted, and in their recommendations, they had no solution or recommendation that really went to the heart of these problems. This commission was established to really bring about accountability. And I wrote this letter to the commissioners a few days later. And later I was contacted by many agents from FAA, from TSA, from CIA, from DIA, saying they have done the same thing. They have testified and they have written letters because this report is not it, and something needs to be done about this. So that's how that project was started. I put together this letter. All these people agreed with it and they signed it. There is this aggressive pursuit of implementing these recommendations and this pressure on the Congress. And to this date, our Congress, our people have been hearing from career politicians, top layer bureaucrats, and from the commissioners. Yet our people have not heard anything from people who actually do the job, did the job, came face to face with these problems, have firsthand experience of these cases and issues and problems. No. Instead, we are only hearing from the politicians.
That was Sybil Edmonds, a former FBI language specialist who was fired after revealing problems at the agency. For more information, visit the website www.911citizenswatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines, produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio, and where you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Rod Richardson, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.